Welcome to the Maris Review. I'm Maris Kreisman. Oh, and I've been waiting for this day for quite a while. Michelle Hart is here. Her fiction has appeared in Joyland and Electric Literature, and she has written nonfiction for Catapult, Nylon, The Rumpus, and The New Yorker Online. Previously, she was the assistant books editor at O, the Oprah Magazine, and Oprah Daily. She received her MFA from Rutgers Newark and lives in New Jersey. Her debut novel is called We Do What We Do in the Dark. Welcome, Michelle.
Thank you. Maris, I've been looking forward to this for a really, really long time too. So thank you.
I feel like it's important for listeners to know that I met Michelle ages ago when there's this phenomenon in book publishing called the marketing lunch. I guess. Publicity lunch?
Yeah.
And various people who care about books, including freelancers and editors and staff writers, are invited to like kind of get a glimpse into the world of what an imprint is going to be publishing. And some of them are really, really fun, and some of them are not as fun. But I always knew if I was sitting next to Michelle, I would have fun. So I want to start out by saying, by asking you, was there anything from those, from all of those lunches that you gleaned about the process of publishing that kind of sticks with you now?
That's a good question. I guess one of the things that's sort of strange, you know, is to be on this other side, right? And I always kind of hoped and imagined I would be on this side of the publishing process, you know, to be the author rather than to be the person covering the authors, though I loved my job. But it was, you know, every day I woke up with some sort of sense of imposter syndrome, you know, like it's sort of like, would I belong on the same shelf as Amy Hempel? Like, no way, right? Like, and, you know, and then I met Amy Hempel, you know, and then I started attending lunches of authors who I had admired from afar and journalists I had admired from afar, including you, Maris, you know, and so it was, if I've gleaned anything from those lunches, I think it's something like, we're all just regular people, you know, we're all just like kind of bumbling along together, you know, there's really, you know, I often look at as published authors as having their shit together, and they just really don't, you know, and, you know, it took me like 10 years to write this book. And, you know, when I'm talking about it with people, it's like, I wrote it yesterday. Mm-hmm. And I experienced that a lot with when I would meet authors in person, you know, I would expect them, especially like, you know, as a journalist or as a book reviewer, you know, talking to authors, that they would be like experts in their own material. Right. But that's so like was not the case. You know, everybody was just kind of like, I don't know, it's a book, you can read it however you want it. And it's kind of freeing, you know. So I guess if I gleaned anything, it would be that.
Yeah. So maybe you know a little bit more how to talk about your own work, which I can only imagine is terrifying.
It's weird. Now, yeah.
I mean, not just imagine, like I've spoken to enough authors who are nervous about it to know that that's a thing. Right. So this debut is so lovely. I love the sentences so much on a sentence level, but I want to start out by talking about, well, the relationship of the book. So your heroine, Mallory, is a freshman in college, and she has an affair with a middle-aged woman who is a professor at that college, but not her professor, which I guess is like sort of important. And she's referred to, we know that Mallory knows her name, but you, yeah, as the author, refer to her only as the woman. And we know she's German, we know she's married, we know she's kind of a stoic person and not gushy, but why does she not receive a name?
Yeah, I thought about that a lot, you know, when I was writing. So the book used to be a short story that I published with Electric Lit. And when I first wrote the story, none of the characters had names. It was Mallory was the girl and the woman was the woman. Sure. And I always liked the story sort of fairy tale lilt that it gave, that, you know, where it sort of felt like this sort of archetypal, almost fable like quality to the story, where it was just about a woman and a girl, you know. It was just sort of, those were their roles in the story, and it allowed me to sort of play with like what those roles mean. Halima Marcus, who published the story, she said something really, really brilliant about it when she published it, when she said that the story is about a girl becoming a woman and a woman becoming a girl. And I've always really loved that. Like, she just got it so well, perfectly. And that's what, you know, allowing the characters to not have names, that's what kind of what it did, right? Where it sort of allowed you, it called attention to their titles, their station in life, their relation to each other. That's a lot harder to do when you're expanding it into a book, right? Sure. You know, and I know that a lot of novels have nameless narrators, you know, but since the book isn't in first person, you know, it's kind of hard to justify that. And so I think I landed on Mallory as a name for a lot of different reasons. I think one day I was walking and trying to think about the book, and I came across a duck, and I was like, oh, mallard, right? like sort of, you know, like really stupid. I don't know, like the duck like sort of felt so innocent, but also a little mean. Like, I don't know, like the mallard had personality, and sort of, you know. And then I think like not too long after that, or at the same time, I'm a big women's soccer fan, and one of my favorite players is Mallory Pugh. And so it just sort of, you know, came to me that to name her that. But when it came time to name the woman, it was really tough, because like there's naming is kind of dichotomous, in the sense that, like, on the one hand, names carry a lot of meaning, right? Like, you know, I remember like being in 15th grade, wow, really, like sophomore year in high school, and reading The Catcher in the Rye, and we spent like a whole class talking about what the name Holden Caulfield means, like what is a call, and what is it, hold, you know. And so, like, you know, being an English major really makes you think about like the choices that, you know, authors make of like naming and how significant it is. You know, so like there was that. I'm like, you know, what name could I possibly give this woman to sort of convey that, you know, sense of importance? And then I looked up like, you know, German first names, and I always kind of had a name for her. I won't say what it is, but you know, but you know, like it was just, it, nothing really worked, right? And you know, I went back and read the short story, and then I just sort of realized that, like, for Mallory, like the woman would always be the woman, right? Like she would always just be that, for, you know, no matter what name she had been given. You know, for her, the woman is something that Mallory aspires to be, right? That she is sort of like the platonic ideal of womanhood for Mallory, right? Not for readers, and not for me, or not for anybody else, right? But for Mallory specifically. And so it gave her a sort of that actually not naming her gave her sort of more significance, I think.
I think so too. And I love the way you describe how Mallory is affected by her. Like you talk about the extreme carefulness with which Mallory conducts herself, like drawing with no eraser and only one piece of paper. And it's like, oh, you have to be careful.
Yeah.
And another detail I love, which is like, so like, I would have done this at age 17, 18. She's invited to the woman's home. She knows the woman is German. She knows she should bring something. So she Googled German wine and brought a Riesling, which the woman, of course, I mean, like bitchily, but rightfully so, was like, this is very sweet. No one has a business like yours with all its strengths and challenges. To succeed, you need a hiring partner that adapts to your needs. You need Indeed. Indeed is the hiring platform for where you can attract, interview, and hire all in one place. Instead of spending hours on multiple job sites searching for candidates with the right skills, Indeed's a powerful hiring partner that can help you do it all. Find greater talent faster through time-saving tools like Indeed Instant Match assessments and virtual interviews. With Instant Match, over 80% of employers get quality candidates whose resume on Indeed matches their job description the moment they sponsor a job, according to Indeed data. Indeed does the hard work for you. When you pay to post a job, Instant Match shows you candidates whose resumes on Indeed fit your description immediately after you post so you can hire faster. Even better, Indeed's the only job site where you only pay for applications that meet your must-have requirements. Join more than 3 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. Start hiring now with a $75 sponsored job credit to upgrade your job post at Indeed.com/Maris. Offer good for a limited time. Claim your $75 credit now at Indeed.com/Maris. Indeed.com/Maris. Terms and conditions apply. Pay per qualified applicant not available for all users. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Tell me about capturing that naivete in a character who we will see progress beyond that point.
That's good. You know, I probably would have also done the Googling the wine thing, right? And to be honest, I still don't really know my white wines that well, you know, even in my 30s, you know, so I wouldn't have really understood that, like, oh, there are some white, like, not all white wines taste the same, you know, that, like, a Riesling is different from a Gewürztraminer, you know, something I still am trying to figure out. But yeah, you know, it was sort of fun to write a character who was like really cunning and knowing in certain ways and aware of the world and aware of herself and just sort of aware of certain things, but like totally ignorantly unaware of other things, right? And so, you know, and I think that that's like, that's definitely like young adulthood. I think that, you know, for whatever reason, there are things where we're very porous at that time, right? Where sort of some things catch, some things don't, right? Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, you know, and the, thank you for calling attention to the eraser line, you know, like I, and you know, I think this, that applies to like romantic relationships certainly, but also sort of, you know, mentorship, mm-hmm. you know, mentee mentor relationships and boss employee relationships, right? Where when we're faced with somebody who we think of as like kind of like more significant than us, right? And for whatever reason, there's a sense of like, oh my God, everything I say is gonna need to be super important. It's gonna be, you know, it's gonna be taken a certain way. It's going to be, you know, and the reality is, it's like, it probably doesn't matter like how she phrases things or you know, or anybody in that situation, right? Like it's probably an overthinking on her part. But you know, when there are times when like, you know, I'll be talking to like a writer who I really admire, and I will realize only afterward that like I don't really remember what I said, because I was so conscious in that moment of saying the right thing that I actually, and weirdly enough, just had this experience where I don't actually remember what I said, you know? And so I think that especially comes from that sort of power dynamic in a relationship where it's sort of, yeah.
Absolutely. And I feel like the book is so good about noticing this thing that we do all the time, which is like, you think you have a bigger role for the most part in someone else's story than perhaps you might. And how much they're thinking about what exactly you said every now and then, you know. But I love that. And I also, you see Mallory kind of looking to this woman for like how to be a person in the world, right? And there are some things that really do seem wonderful about the relationship, especially at first. That this is a very 17-year-old thing to say, but like secret relationships are fun. Like that fills it with drama and excitement. And there is something exciting about that. And even just the idea of like feeling lustful and having that lust being shared and acknowledged and fulfilled. Tell me about kind of parceling through the more negative aspects of this relationship that that you cover so brilliantly.
Yeah, it was a tricky balance to strike, right? Especially because, you know, I started writing this book way before like Me Too, right? And so I had been writing the relationship a certain way and sort of, you know, the dynamic sort of, you know, in a certain way. And then, you know, 2017, 2018, 2019 was when I was sort of, wrapping up the book, you know, and it just sort of struck me that I would be hesitant to call this like a Me Too novel. I don't really know what that means. I don't know if it is that, though I'm sure there are some reader out there who will make that connection. But I did realize that, you know, this narrative participated in parts of that conversation, right? Or, you know, like the role of autonomy in a relationship between two people who are very different in age and station in life, right? But the thing about Me Too that really struck me was the way that it sort of caused women and other people to sort of recontextualize the past relationships, right? We suddenly had like new words and phrases and experiences that we could then use to look back and say, oh, actually that was kind of like this, right? Like that's sort of what's going on here. And, you know, so then it didn't really change much about the dynamic that I was writing and how I was writing it, but it gave me a sense of like what the stakes are, right? And so like, it was important for me, and without spoiling anything about like the end of the book, you know, it was really important for me to end it with somebody else asking about the relationship, right? Because it's essentially for most of the book, it's like a two-person play, right? You know, it's just sort of these two people alone in a room together, you know, the affair is kind of like a story that only two people know, right? And that's the appeal of it, as you alluded to earlier, right? That's like, that's the fun thing about affairs sometimes, where it's just sort of like the superiority that you feel about knowing something that's going on that other people don't know, right? And so then it was important to sort of say, you know, well, like what happens when somebody else impresses their opinion of this relationship upon Mallory, you know, and I think that Mallory would be really, really hesitant and reluctant to define the relationship that she has with the woman as a Me Too relationship, right? Or as something that sort of conforms to the contours of what we think of as that kind of relationship. Even though there is a solid case to be made that there are similarities, right? You know, that she was a student and the woman was a professor, though, as you said, and it's a very important distinction that she's not Mallory's professor, you know, and just what does it mean to be a 40 something in a relationship with an 18 year old? You know, if that was a man in a relationship with a woman, a young woman, you know, we would immediately, you know, toss up the red flags, right? So yeah, you know, it was a really tricky balance to strike. You know, I think that the woman, I think it's questionable, right? I think that like, and I want people to question it, and I did too at every turn. Like this book is not at all meant to be didactic and to sort of say like, this is wrong what these two are doing and how they're behaving, but it's not right. Right. it's sort of like that one of my mentor, Akhil Sharma, has this thing. He said this thing about his novel Family Life. And the interviewer asked him, you know, it took him like 12 years to write that book. And an interviewer asked him, how did you know the book was done? Right. And he said this really brilliant thing that he said, I knew the book was done when everybody was wrong and everybody was right. Mm. Right. And so, yeah, right. Like it's so, and that kind of, you know, really helped propel me along, you know, and sort of, we all think we're the heroes of our stories, right? And then we think that other people are the villains of the story, or the other people are the, to use video game terminology, the NPCs, the non-playable characters, right? But, you know, everybody, you know, has their own version of the story, and maybe Mallory's is not right. It's also not wrong. Mm-hmm. And anybody's take on Mallory's story is not necessarily right or wrong, right? Like, so like anybody questioning this relationship as being bad, you know, as I'm sure people will, you know, I mean, there's people, a lot of people say that like the relationship in Call Me By Your Name, for instance, is like a bad relationship just because of the age disparity. There will always be people who sort of read it as sort of black and white. And so it was really important to maintain that gray area-ness of it.
Yeah. And I think it's such a good contrast. You talk about how, yeah, teachers need this course, but also it's so good for writers to be studying how to tell a story so succinctly. Maybe the better question is like, talk about the distinctions you wanted to make, or like the themes you wanted to carry with children's literature.
Yeah, I mean, I think that for me, like what was interesting about a character like the woman being a children's book author, right? Like we sort of think of children's book authors as like being good with kids, right? Mm-hmm. That's kind of like the base thing, like idea that we have in our heads, right? And like, you know, I had read a profile in the New Yorker of Maurice Sendak, who obviously is like the kids book, like, right, the picture book mm-hmm. author. Like you, when you think of picture books, you think of Where the Wild Things Are and Maurice Sendak, and it's just such a brilliant book. And this New Yorker profile was sort of talking about how he was a childless gay guy, which I never would have imagined the man who wrote Where the Wild Things Are was A, gay, and B, childless, you know, like how did, you know, like obviously all adults are kids at one point, like I think that's pretty obvious, right? But you know, like he just had such a mastery, like our childhoods were so defined by Max, right? And the Rumpus and stuff like that. And you know, he had made the quintessential kid story and didn't have kids. So it was sort of, it was that was sort of interesting for me to sort of try to incorporate in some way, right? And then just, you know, like and the woman is also childless, and you know, I think what draws the woman to picture books and what draws her to the artistry of picture books is sort of representing childhood, right? Like we're sort of revisiting childhood, which is something that I think the woman doesn't think she had, what a childhood, in much the same way that Mallory's childhood was very, very complicated by illness in the family, and the way that sort of prevented her from having, I guess, quote unquote, a real childhood. And so, you know, there's sort of that like traumatic element to it, but, you know, I and also, yeah, you know, I I learned a lot about writing prose from kids' books, especially like Harold and the Purple Crayon, which I reference explicitly in the book, which is such a, like, I just reread it the other day. It's just like so brilliant, right? Like it's so simple. But as the woman even says in the book, right? Like that kind of simplicity is really hard. Right, like there is a level of artistry to boiling something down to its most essential elements, enough for all ages to comprehend what's being said, right? That's just really, really hard to pull off. And I started sort of, you know, the more kids' book that I read, the more I realized what a prize clarity is, right? And like, you know, I love like Garth Greenwell and Susan Choi and sentences with so many clauses that you have to read them again to figure out what the hell's going on, right? But you know, when it came down to it, what attracted me about writing and what sort of was important to go into the book explicitly was the kind of you know, sort of less is more thing.
Mm-hmm. And I do feel like another angle on children's literature right now, unfortunately, is that so many books that can teach kids about the world perhaps are being banned.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that there's a book banners want to bring the shame back.
Yeah.
Tell me about shame in your novel and its complexities, because that this is not a very straightforward kids book answer.
Yeah, you know, the rendering of shame I find very, very interesting when it's done in fiction. You know, like I mentioned Garth Greenwell earlier, and he's one who just does it really, really well. And Leopoldine Hoare is another author who I wish more people would read. The way that she handles shame, you know, especially in women, you know, the dichotomy between shame and shamelessness is really, really compelling. And so, yeah, you know, like I struggled with it because on the one hand, like as a queer author, like you kind of don't want to tell a story about shame, right? Because like, you don't want it to be like, oh, you know, this girl's ashamed of her identity. Mm-hmm. Like that's the thing, right? We all are, we're just shamed, you know, just full of shame all the time. But you know, ultimately to ignore shame entirely would have been disingenuous, right? Like that is something we all feel, right? Whether we display it in certain ways or not. And so it became about trying to figure out how shame works as a plot propeller, right? And so for me, like, you know, there's sort of two levels of shame, right? I think that on one hand, there's shame that's uncontrollable, right? And this shame comes from, you know, external views of yourself and who society thinks you are and should be and wants you to be, right? And so queer people have no control over, you know, how they're going to be perceived, right? They, you know, that it just sort of like, you know, queerness is in the eye of the straight beholder, right? And so then, you know, so how does that work as a vehicle to get sort of story going? And I think that when people feel uncontrollable shame, a lot of times, especially younger people, sort of seek out ways to work out to do shameful things, right? There feels like something that like is compelling to sort of to act in a way that in such a way that shame is controllable, right? And so, you know, like on the one hand, Mallory can't, you know, you know, she's not the most beautiful girl ever. And, you know, at being a non-beautiful girl is a shame in and of itself. And being queer, of course, there's a lot of shame there, and having, a dead parent is shameful in some ways, right? Where, especially when most of your peers, have parents who are both alive. Right. But those are shames that you just can't control, right? And so I think then, like, it seems to me, especially like in fiction, you know, where a character would sort of use that shame as a jumping off point, almost as an excuse to do like things that they know they're not supposed to do, mm-hmm. right? To do shameful things. Not that her relationship with the woman is shameful, but it's not great. You know, it's not like a thing that would be encouraged, you know, and I think that the relationship is Mallory's way, and even the woman's way of balancing these sort of uncontrollable shames versus, like, you know, the shame that we have control over.
I love that. I also like the idea, and this is a very teenage idea, I think, anytime anyone wallows, I feel like it's so satisfying. Especially like when you have a good playlist and you like this feeling of melancholy. But one of the things that Mallory really struggles with is, what if sadness is part of her identity, if not, like, you know, in her teenage mind, maybe it's the whole thing.
Yeah.
Say more.
Yeah, no, I think it's great to point that out, right? You know, I guess that's part of, you know, it is a teenager thing to do, right? Like, to sort of, I think that's why a lot of people of my generation certainly, you know, grew up on emo, right? Which is sort of like, mm-hmm. you know, we were the emo kids. And I guess like Tumblr people now would be like the Lana Del Rey generation, right? or whoever the new Lana Del Rey is.
And I am part of the Fiona Apple generation. So
Right. I mean, there's a very straight line from Fiona Apple to Lana Del Rey. You know, you and I both spent way too much time on Tumblr. So, you know, you and I are the Tumblr sad girls, right? But I think that, you know, for Mallory, like, there's a compelling aloneness to sadness, right? Which I think of the the pleasing egotism of grief, I would say, right? Mm-hmm. Where, you know, like, how fucking good does it feel sometimes to just sit alone in a dark room, you know, not talking to anybody, and just think about nothing else but how shitty you feel, right? Like that, like, there are very few purely satisfying experiences as you said, wallowing, right? And that's why we wallow, because I mean, it just feels good, like, in the moment, right? And I think that a lot of times sadness feels very unique, right? There's like that Tolstoyism, right? You know, unhappy people are unalike, you know, right? And so I think that for girls like Mallory, for people like Mallory, for kids, I mean, even I'm in my 30s now and I still feel this way, right? Mm-hmm. Where it's just sort of like, there's like, and you know, Mallory spent so much time as a kid alone, and she came to both prize that time alone, but also to sort of decry that time alone, right? Where it sort of, and I think that was what was interesting for me about Mallory, you know, sort of working out when is sadness like worth just ruminating on, and when is sadness just worth like saying, fuck it, forget it, mm-hmm. you know? And so I like the sort of play with those two things.
Absolutely. And that does seem like a spectrum from girl to womanhood.
Yeah, for sure. Right.
And I think the last thing I want to talk to you about before I ask you for book recommendations.
Yeah.
Is I like the idea that to Mallory, this affair is life-changing. And of course, she will always think about the woman. The woman is the woman. But tell me about what actually affects one's whole life. Like you end the book when Mallory is 28. So we don't actually get to see like what she's like in her middle ages. But
does the world not end when you're 28?
but I had a suspicion of what was going to happen. Tell me.
I actually kind of want to know what your suspicion was.
I feel like with any really intense love affair or any intense heartache, yes, some things about that relationship will stay with you forever. And yet as you mature, you kind of realize that it wasn't the world-ending thing, world-changing thing that you thought it would be. Am I right?
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think you're totally right. Yeah. You know, I think for the woman does so much for Mallory, right? Like, and, you know, sort of, and this is what sort of adds to the ambiguity of the relationship, right? Where Mallory, the woman encourages certain facets of Mallory's identity that maybe haven't really been encouraged in Mallory before, right? Like this sort of burgeoning sensuality, right? And this sort of drive to be an artist and to take art seriously, mm-hmm. right? Those are things that like no one had ever really, you know, spoken to her about or encouraged in her. And, you know, that's something that the woman does for her, right? And mm-hmm. and there's a line at the end of the book, right, where Caroline, the girl her own age, who she's going out with, I guess woman, right? She's 28. And when do we stop being girls?
Well, that's a big question.
Yeah. Right. You know, and she sort of, you know, Mallory kind of maybe a little bittersweetly says that the version of me sitting before you today is only possible because of her. Right. And I think that's sort of like, you know, a lot of people use the phrase formative relationship. And I think that is true, right? Where a lot of the way Mallory experiences the world and the way she articulates the world to herself and to other people mm-hmm. came right from the woman, right? And obviously that's like a double-edged sword, right? Because, you know, on the one hand, like it's really nice to have the words for something, right? It's really nice to be told how you are, right? Like, you know, by other people. But on the other hand, that's work that you don't do for yourself, right? That so the work of formation of identity was not something that was sort of available to Mallory in that specific relationship, right? And so that's sort of like the catch 22 of a relationship with such a skewed power dynamic, right? Where it's sort of like, you know, you almost defer to the other person, right? To sort of define you, right? And so you don't get to define yourself. You know, and I think that there's positives and negatives to that, you know, especially for somebody who's neurotic, right? Like Mallory, who would just sort of, you know, being asked who you are would send her into sort of an existential spiral, right? Like as I think most of us would answer that question, you know, feeling deep existential despair. But, you know, and so it's comforting, you know, to sort of be able to fall back on, well, who I am is who this woman told me I am. And so, you know, and I think that's what is really significant about the relationship between Mallory and the woman, right? Where like there's, it's clearly like, you know, and it's not to say that she wouldn't have learned those things on her own, you know, but I do think that like the woman, at least in that specific case, sort of sped up the process, I guess, for lack of a better sort of phrasing.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Great. Michelle, before we go, please recommend some books for us.
Yeah. So I guess not to steal my own thunder, but there are quite a lot of books coming out in May that are very good. And one that I want to specifically highlight is a book called Yerba Buena by Nina LaCour, I think. Nina LaCour, I'm not sure how to say her last name. She had made a name for herself sort of like as a YA author. Mm-hmm. And this is like positioned as her first adult book.
Mm-hmm. Scared.
Yeah, I did. I guess it's important to note that I think it is a very adult book. You could also just sort of argue that, other her YA books dealt with like suicide and stuff that's like a, you know, very adult topics. Where the line, begins and ends with YA versus adult is just sort of beyond me, I guess. I guess that's why we've created new adult as a category, right? To sort of say, oh, it's that, right? But Yerba Buena is this really beautiful story set over decades about these sort of two women who just sort of, they have really terrible teenage years, and then they sort of meet by chance at a restaurant in San Francisco. It's sort of, there's a lot of relief in that relationship, of finding someone who's as lost as you, right? And how nice of a feeling that is. But there's also, to talk about double-edged swords, there's also a sense of like, well, both of us are lost, how do we find ourselves, and is it possible to do that when neither of you has a sense of who you are, how does a relationship proceed from that point? It's a really, really beautiful story. The prose is gorgeous. I learned a lot about mixology. One of the characters is a mixologist. She talks about sort of different, drink combinations. it's just Love a really, that. Really pretty book that I would highly recommend. I've also just started, One other one that I would recommend. I would always recommend the work of Marcy Dermansky. I think she's like one of the most undersung, writers around. She's all killer, no filler, right? She's consistently, banging out bangers. I was a huge fan of The Red Car, and then Very Nice came out, and I was like, that's somehow better than The Red Car, which is a book that I love. So I just started reading Hurricane Girl, which is her new book. It comes out in June. And it's got that same sort of dry humor, the same sort of fucked upness, and just like she's so singularly good at what she does, that like always recommend Marcy Dermansky.
I love that. Michelle, thank you so much. I'm really excited for you.
Thank you for listening to the Maris Review, and check the show notes for the books we discussed on here today. And please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.